The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. It is a Wednesday. Wednesday. Welcome to it. This week, Wednesday gave us some more Supreme Court decisions because they are racing against the clock to get them all done. They gave four of them today. And I don't know if I should be calling them decisions or opinions. Because the justices write opinions, but basically they're decisions on the cases. I don't know. I don't know what the proper vernacular is. So I'll just probably alternate between the two. And today they handed down four rulings, as it were. One of them was one of the biggies, and it was the case of the girl, the high school cheerleader, who I forget what happened, but you know, she did what high school kids do. She got cut or suspended from the cheer squad, I think, for a year, for her senior year of high school, if I remember correctly. And so she posted something on Snapchat, and it was like, fuck school, fuck cheer, fuck this, fuck everything, something like that. And for that, the school like suspended her, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And basically the Supreme Court said, this is how kids talk. This is what it is. And Stephen Breyer wrote the opinion, and it was 8-1, the one being Clarence Thomas, of course. And, you know, they said kids will be kids and free speech and all that jazz. So that happened. There were three other cases as well, but that was the biggie for the day. Although some will tell you that another one was a biggie. And this one was, it was a 6-3 decision. This was down ideological lines. So it was the three so-called liberal justices who had the dissent, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Breyer, and the six right-wingers on the court. Basically backed businesses challenging California labor law. I heard someone say that the today's Supreme Court just wiped out everything that was done by Cesar Chavez. Let me just read to you from HuffPost. The Supreme Court on Wednesday sided with California agriculture businesses in their challenge to a state regulation that gives unions access to farm property in order to organize workers. As a result of the ruling, California will have to modify or abandon the regulation put in place in 1975 due to the efforts of labor leader Cesar Chavez. The justices ruled 6-3 along ideological lines for the agriculture businesses. It's another potential setback for unions as a result of a Supreme Court decision. This Supreme Court has not been very labor friendly. So we'll just say that. There were a couple of others too. And to be honest with you, I was so busy. I forgot because the court generally, when they start issuing these opinions regularly, do it on Mondays and Thursdays. But because the term ends at the end of the month, which is coming up, a week from today, that would leave them only like one more day to give these opinions. So allegedly, they've got two more opinion days, this Friday and then Monday of next week. And still to be decided, the biggie left, they've already announced four of the five big ones that were outstanding before, like last week. And it was what we talked about last week. It was the, I'm drawing a blank, because I'm having one of those weeks. Although Mercury's out of retrograde already, so things should be getting better, right? Right. So it was the Affordable Care Act, duh, and we're gonna deal with that later on in the show. So hold that thought. The Affordable Care Act. What were the other ones? Do I still have this? Of course, I have my notes here, and let me see if I can't. it's not letting me open it. Here we go. Okay, so it was this one today. The for student free speech, and she won. So a First Amendment decision over how much control schools have off of off-campus student speech, and the court ruled basically none. Let's see, the NCAA decision that we mentioned the other day. What did I just do here? All right, I have no idea what I did there. And I think I closed. No, I didn't. Okay, the NCAA decision, which we announced, right? This one, the next one is Obamacare, which we talked about and we'll talk about again today. And the same-sex foster parents in the city of Philadelphia. So the one big, big case that we're kind of worrying about still to be announced is on voting rights. Hello. It is Brnovich versus the DNC. The case concerns a pair of voting limits in Arizona. One of the disputed policies requires election officials to throw out entire ballots cast in the wrong precinct, even in statewide races where a voter's polling place has no bearing on the outcome of the race. And the second Arizona policy at issue generally forbids so-called ballot harvesting. So in other words, I can't go around my neighborhood or my retirement home and collect the mail-in ballots from everybody and bring them all to drop them off. That's what they're challenging. They're calling it ballot harvesting. So that decision will come either Friday or potentially Monday up until Wednesday of next week, which is when this term of the Supreme Court ends. And then they reconvene, what is it, the first Monday in October. Such as it is. And then we wait and see if Stephen Breyer does the right thing and retires. So that happened today. So we got one of the biggies, and it was a good ruling, although the labor ruling was not so good. And there was another one having to do with, I think, like Goldman Sachs or something, that of course was not good for, you know, the little guy like you and me. But that one's above my pay grade. All right. Let's see. What else? There are other things that I do want to talk to you about. Let me grab my notes here if I can get this page open again. It's right here. Okay. So the New York City mayoral primaries were yesterday, but we don't have a winner yet because New York City used, for the very first time, ranked choice voting, which is great. But apparently, neither the candidates nor the media in New York did a good job of educating people on how it works. And the way it works, they had 13 candidates on the ballot. When you took your ballot, you had a place to mark your choices first through fifth. So you would say, you'd fill in the bubble. If I were voting in New York, I would have voted for Maya Wiley. So she would have been my number one choice. Frankly, then I would have picked the worst candidates, the ones who had no chance whatsoever of getting in. Like Andrew Yang, who, by the way, placed fourth with like only 11% of the vote. He conceded. He dropped out because, you know, I guess he saw the writing on the wall. So maybe Andrew Yang, although it didn't look so bad for him before the vote. But the guy who's been accused of sexual assault, I think his last name is Stringer, who is basically only still on the ballot because it was too late to take his name off. So what happens is, at the end of the first round of counting, the candidate at the bottom of the barrel drops off. And then those ballots, they get cast for the second choice. So everything has to be recalculated. And it goes on and on like that. So after last night, all they counted, all that was counted as of last night, when you heard the results that they have so far, were the in-person first choice votes. So no mail-in, no absentee voting, and none of the weighted stuff yet. And Adams, the Brooklyn bureau president, borough president. I know Brooklyn is a borough. I know Manhattan, New York has five boroughs. I lived there for much of my life, so it's just a brain fart. The Brooklyn borough president, a guy named Adams, he is in the lead, but again, it's based on solely the in-person voting, first choice only, if that makes sense. And it's going to be about 2 weeks, maybe even a little longer, before it all shakes out. But the surprise, the good surprise, was Maya Wiley is in second place. And she could, depending on how these ballots go and the how many people have her in second place and put this Adams guy further down, it could shake out very differently. It'll be interesting to watch. I think that's the way we need to go in the future is with ranked choice voting. And it saves, you know, it'll save a fortune on runoff elections and stuff like that. But people have to understand how it works. And apparently they didn't do a great job in New York of that. All right. Moving on down my line of topics that I wanted to share with you. Well, I guess I should tell you who's coming up on the show first. So going back to the Supreme Court decision. So last week we got the biggie first, like the biggest one that for me. That I was waiting on was the decision on the latest challenge to the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Because frankly, without it, it's just a matter of time. I'm dead. Because before the Affordable Care Act, and now we're going back 12 years, I was unable to purchase insurance. I was already a cancer survivor. My lung cancer wasn't, that was 5 years ago, but I had had a malignant melanoma, which is cancer. So I was, you know, I'm riddled with pre-existing conditions. And seriously, the year before the Affordable Care Act passed, I had lost my last full-time job. Working for Clear Channel, you know, iHeartRadio here in Miami when they still had a progressive talk station on the air. It's now the fifth sports talk station in town. They killed off the progressive talk station the Friday before the Democratic convention in 2008. At the time, I was doing the morning show there. I was doing mornings. So I had insurance through them. But once they fired me, so that they could flip to sports. That was my last job that provided health insurance. You know, after that, I went to Air America, but I was an independent contractor. I had to get my own insurance. And I could not get insurance on the open market because, you know, pre-existing conditions. So thankfully, the Affordable Care Act came along at just the right time. So I've been able to be covered. And that's a good thing because, you know, 5 years ago, I had lung cancer. And if the cancer didn't kill me, the bills would have. So anyway, we know the good news is the Supreme Court once again declined to kill the Affordable Care Act, which is what the Republican Party has been actively trying to do for the last 10, 11 years. So we're going to be joined by Jonathan Cohn. Jonathan Cohn writes for HuffPost. He covers healthcare. Years ago, he wrote the book Sick, and he was always one of my go-to guys on healthcare issues. Well, during the pandemic, Jonathan released another book. I'm sure he wrote it before the pandemic, and it's called The 10-Year War, Obamacare and the Unfinished Crusade for Universal Coverage. So we're going to check in with him and see, you know, what I thought was supposed to happen and what we were told all during the campaign was, you know, Bernie Sanders and some others were pushing for Medicare for all. Joe Biden was never in that group. But he was saying we're going to have a public option, at least have a Medicare-like plan that we could buy into. And the people who wanted to continue being bilked and taken advantage of by the for-profit insurance industry could. They could continue paying exorbitant fees. But those of us who wanted to buy in to a Medicare-like system, a public option, would be able to. Well, all of a sudden, we're not hearing anything about a public option. So we'll check in with Jonathan Cohn at the bottom of the hour and we'll find out the latest, the prognosis of our U.S. healthcare system, such as it is. Okay, so there's that. Now I can get back to the stuff that's going on if I could bring my notes back up again. My computer, just so you know, is very temperamental. And I have these notes open, but I have so many different programs running between the video streaming and the audio streaming that sometimes it doesn't like to cooperate, but it is now. Okay, so yesterday we saw Kamala Harris. Actually, if you were listening yesterday and you left early, well, we stayed on the air. I stayed on because in the Senate, they were voting. It was a cloture vote to open debate on the For the People Act. I was going to say arguably the most important bill facing Congress today. Forget the arguably. It is, or I guess I should say it was, because the Republicans effectively killed it last night. So I stayed on the air as the vote was going on to get to the end of it. And the end of it was just what we said it was going to be, 50-50. Now, if our Senate operated the way it was designed to operate, Kamala Harris was in the right place. She was presiding over the Senate in her role as Senate president. She was on the Hill for another reason, a confirmation hearing where she had to break a tie to confirm, and I don't have her name in front of me, I'm sorry, but a woman of color who Joe Biden nominated to head up the Office of Management and Budget. Yeah, because Neera Tanden's gone, right, because she didn't get through. So it was a woman of color, and of course all the Republicans voted against her, so Kamala Harris broke the tie. She was confirmed. Harris was there, so she went over and presided over this session in the Senate where they voted, and it came out 54-50 against. And again, if we were operating under normal rules, majority rules, Kamala Harris in her role as Senate president would have broken the tie and they would have begun debate on the For the People Act. Again, this wasn't to pass the bill. This wasn't to start, you know, fixing the problems that the Republicans are causing in our election system. This was to open debate, and not one Republican would vote to open debate. What are they afraid of? I know they're afraid of the truth coming out. So that's what happened, right? So I stayed on the air yesterday until that all shook out. But I got it. This I heard something. On CNN, CNN played this little clip that caught my attention so much so that I'm like, wait a minute, what was that? And I ran it back on the DVR thing. And I even like a videotaped it on my phone because I said, I got to go find this video. And what the video was, it was from 1963, right? 1963, Martin Luther King, July 5th, 1963. And I actually thought it was an episode of Meet the Press, because that's what it looked like, but it wasn't. It was a televised press conference of sorts. It was put on by USAID, the United States. It's international. I forget what USAID stands for, but it's an international thing. And this was for overseas, for other nations to see. In fact, the way it was set up, the way it works is that this program could not be seen here in the United States for 12 months after its taping or filming, I guess back then it was before videotape. I don't quite understand that part of it, but the fact remains that it was this Martin Luther King Jr. talking with these journalists about the filibuster and how the filibuster was being used to keep people from voting. How fascinating, huh? So I found it, and actually I found the entire thing, not just the quick couple of seconds that CNN played. So I pulled a clip to share with you that I'm going to. It's a few minutes long, but it's so worth it. And I'm going to post the entire program. It's a 30-minute show. I'll post it on the blog today at NicoleSandler.com/6-23-21. That's the date. That's the format. That's how I always post each day's show, along with the supporting information like this video. So you can go anytime, like an hour after I get off the air, you can go there and find it and watch the whole thing. It's fascinating. It is absolutely fascinating. And when you realize, again, this is July 5th, 1963, and just listen in this clip what Martin Luther King Jr. is talking about. It's going to blow your mind. I hope you're ready.
The majority of people in the United States would vote favorably for such a bill. I think the tragedy is that We have a Congress with a Senate that has a minority of misguided senators who will use the filibuster to keep the majority of people from even voting. They won't let the majority of senators vote. And certainly they wouldn't want the majority of people to vote because they know they do not represent the majority of the American people. In fact, they represent in their own states a very small minority. Senator Eastland of Mississippi represents a very small minority of the number of people who live in that state.
Right.
And I think this is true all across the South.
Well, is not this part of the American system? And then you would, in effect, change the system so that there would be dictation from executive office rather than legislation under our present system of representation?
Well, this is a system, but it is not democratically applied in so many southern states. Let us take the state of Mississippi as an example. You have about 20,000 Negroes registered to vote in the state of Mississippi. Now, many of these people are not registered because all types of conniving methods are still being used to keep Negroes from becoming registered voters.
And
in fact, some
shit?
Are even killed for seeking to lead voter registration drives, so that the democratic process is not operative in situations like Mississippi and Alabama and so many of the other states, southern states, where there is this determined effort to keep Negroes from becoming registered voters.
Well, let me say this, that if the right to vote, which is a basic civil right, is prescribed both by the Constitution and by statute, I think there can be no one to impede that. But I'm confused over what you term to be basic constitutional rights, which would give the federal government authority to direct one's private business.
Wow.
Under what section of the Constitution would you say that could be done?
Well, I think it could be done under several sections, but I would like to see it under the 14th Amendment, which says that
the 14th Amendment, right?
Has a right to deny an individual equal protection of the law, and every state has a responsibility, it has the authority to give these businesses licenses to operate. And the fact that this is done by the state means that these businesses at that moment forfeit the right to deal with individuals any way they please. They must.
You know, talk about somebody so ahead of his time. Again, I'm going to post the entire program. It's a half hour long show. And it is fascinating. But there you have Martin Luther King from July of 1963 talking about how the filibuster is being used to keep black people from voting. It's astounding. Do you know we've come full circle? Because it was after that that they, you know, he, King, with an assist from Johnson, got the Voting Rights Act passed in 1965. And by the way, when I was looking for this clip, I happened upon an episode of Meet the Press from 1965, in which the press, they were just brutal on him. The way Meet the Press used to work is similar to this. He would sit on one side and three members of the media would question him. And you know what? I'll post that one as well so that you can watch both of them. It is fascinating. But all the work that he did and all the work that the nation did towards civil rights and equality, it seems like we are taking giant steps backwards to where we are now. The fact that he said that, over 50 years ago, and we're going through it again now, that should be played. That clip should be played for every member of Congress, every single one, especially the Republicans who just don't get it. They just don't get it. I was going to take a break here, but I have one more thing that I do want to play for you before Jonathan Cohn shows up. And this happened today. Sorry, I'm jumping around, but there are a few issues I just wanted to hit on before the interview. And this one is astounding. There's a hearing going on today. It's probably still going on for all I know, in the House Armed Services Committee. And there are actually two clips here that I don't know if I'm going to have time for. Let me start with the first one. The first one is It is Mike Milley. He's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And which video is him? Is that, that's not, that's a defense secretary. That's the wrong one. Milley, where are you? Mike Milley. I'm losing my mind. I know I had it here. That's defense secretary. That's new Fox News, Fox News. Why do I not have it up on this? Oh, here it is. Joint Chiefs Chairman, Mark Milley. Okay, so this is, for some reason, they were talking about critical race theory in what? In the military? Being taught in the military? I mean, I don't get it. It just doesn't make sense to me. But let's just hear what the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff had to say about this nonsense that they are pushing, that they are, alleging is going on. Where are we? We're right here. All right. So here you go. This is Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley. Take it away, General.
Well, obviously, I have to get much smarter on whatever the theory is. But I do think it's important, actually, for those of us in uniform to be open-minded and be widely read. And the United States Military Academy is a university, and it is important that we train and we understand. And I want to understand white rage, and I'm white, and I want to understand it. So what is it that caused thousands of people to assault this building and try to overturn the Constitution of the United States of America? What caused that?
Yeah, good question.
I want to find that out.
Right?
I want to maintain an open mind here, and I do want to analyze it. It's important that we understand that, because our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Guardians, they come from the American people. So it is important that the leaders, now and in the future, do understand it. I've read Mao Zedong. I've read Karl Marx.
Okay.
I've read Lenin. That doesn't make me a communist.
Nope.
So what is wrong with understanding, having some situational understanding about the country for which we are here to defend? And I personally find it offensive that we are accusing the United States military, our general officers, our commissioned, non-commissioned officers, of being, quote, woke or something else,
Matt,
because
Gaetz
we're studying
sneering.
Some theories that are out there. That was started at Harvard Law School years ago, and it proposed that there were laws in the United States, antebellum laws prior to the Civil War, that led to a power differential with African Americans that were three quarters of a human being when this country was formed. And then we had a Civil War and Emancipation Proclamation to change it. And we brought it up to the Civil Rights Act in 1964. It took another 100 years to change that. So look it, I do want to know. And I respect your service, and you and I are both Green Berets. But I want to know. And it matters to our military and the discipline and cohesion of this military. And I thank you for the opportunity to make a comment on that.
Thank you, General.
How awesome was that? The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff basically calling bullshit on the objections to critical race theory, which, by the way, this whole argument is bullshit because it's not being taught in schools. There's no fourth grader out there being taught anything about something called critical race theory. It's just not happening. This is another nonsensical issue being, just being thrown into the mix by the Republicans who are afraid to talk about issues about things that really matter. Oh, like, you know, healthcare or something like that. But you'll notice in that shot, they cut away to Matt Gaetz, who was shaking his head, and Jonathan, stand by, because I got to play one more clip. And this is in the same hearing before the House Armed Services Committee, and you had this time it was the Defense Secretary. Let me get this clip up because Matt Gaetz was questioning him, and first of all, why is Matt Gaetz still in Congress? That's what I want to know. Why does he have the opportunity to question the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff with the charges that are out there against him? That's what I would like to know. Well, I'd like to know a lot more than just that, too. But here, just watch and see what a sniveling, slimy piece of dung Matt Gaetz really is. Check this out. And get angry.
In my previous discussions with service members and particularly officers, I would hear about complaints over parts not arriving on time.
And just so you know, the reason I'm playing this is because the Secretary of Defense puts Matt Gaetz in his place. And I could just imagine him going home and, you know, crying to, I was going to say mommy, but whoever it is he hangs out with these days.
They say that your stand down regarding extremism did not help our military. It hurt the military. And I want to share with you that perspective, that it caused service members to otherize one another. It impaired group cohesion. And interesting to me is that I've heard those sentiments most frequently from units that are majority-minority.
Bullshit.
That this was not particularly helpful. So I wanted to give you the opportunity to maybe share with us more specificity regarding
the definitions. Oh, sure. That's what you want
to
do here. That's why you're doing
this. Ms. Hartzler was asking
grandstanding.
Questions. How should the Department of Defense think about critical race theory?
Could I make a comment? Secretary, I'm sorry.
Well, I'm very limited on my time.
Well, I just want to make a comment. The feedback,
well, I know, but I've got,
this
I've
is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who wants to make a comment, and he's not letting him.
The issue of critical race theory is and what the relevance here in with the department.
This is the Secretary of Defense,
not
Austin.
We don't teach critical race theory. We don't
Hello.
Embrace
Hello.
Critical race theory. And I think that's a spurious conversation. And so we are focused on extremist behaviors. And not ideology, not people's thoughts, not people's political orientation.
Thank you.
Behaviors is what we're focused on. But and one final point, and
yes,
thanks for your anecdotal
you
input, but I would say that I have gotten 10 times that amount of input, 50 times that amount of input,
yep,
on the other side that have said, hey, we're glad to have had the ability to have a conversation with ourselves and with our leadership. And that's what we need to make
and
sure.
And again,
that
reclaiming my time, Mr. Secretary.
Oh God!
It may be that you're receiving that input in the ratios you describe because it was your directive. It may be that people are concerned about criticizing your decision because Lieutenant Colonel Lohmeyer was not relieved of his command for his actions. He was not relieved of his command because of poor performance.
All right. You know what? You know what I feel about Matt Gaetz. So you heard the Secretary of Defense. Tell him what's going on. Now we've got a song for Mr. Gaetz. Jonathan Cohn, you might want to cover your ears because, you know, it could be offensive to some.
I just need you to shut the fuck up because nobody asked you, bitch. I need you to shut the fuck up, bitch. Shut the fuck up, bitch. Just shut the fuck up, bitch. Shut the fuck up, bitch.
Bam, bam.
Shut the fuck up.
Shut the fuck up. Bam, bam.
Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up. Bam, bam. Shut the fuck up.
We're going to just let him sing. All right, and we're done with Matt Gaetz just like that. See how easy it is to get him to shut the fuck up? I want to send that to somebody in Congress who, when he starts this kind of stuff, they can play it for him. All right, but I'll think about that. In the meantime, let's welcome our guest and change subject matter here. Jonathan Cohn is a reporter for HuffPost. He's been writing about health issues and our healthcare system for many, many years over there. His first book was Sick. We talked about that many times over the years. And then I found out last week after doing some research after the Supreme Court again declined to overturn the Affordable Care Act that Jonathan released another book during the pandemic. I guess the pandemic is not a great time to release the book because you couldn't go on a book tour, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we did some virtual events. I have to say, I truly missed the book tour. You know, last book, which was all about the problems of our healthcare system, the book tour was almost like a second research tour. People would show up at talks. They would tell me their stories.
Sure.
I learned so much. So I missed that a lot. And yeah, so I mean, that to me was one of the... Yeah, I mean, there are many terrible things about the pandemic. Very low on the list of terrible things, but still something that I definitely felt was I missed that interaction.
Right. And I didn't even know. I didn't get pitched on your book, and I somehow missed it. But I found it now, so I'm glad it's here. The book is called The 10-Year War, Obamacare and the... Sorry, I'm old. And vision is not covered under Obamacare, go figure. But it's called Obamacare and the Unfinished Crusade for Universal Coverage. I read it correctly, right?
Yes.
And it is exactly that. there are so many things that are wrong with the Affordable Care Act that are bad about it. But I always, anytime I discuss it, I have to say that it's probably the reason I'm here today. It's probably the reason I'm alive, because I had those pre-existing conditions back in 2010 when the Affordable Care Act passed. I had started working at Air America, but I was an independent contractor. I had lost my last full-time job that provided health insurance, so I was on my own. I had to get it on the open market. And with pre-existing conditions and being a cancer survivor, that was impossible. And then this happened. At just the right time, thankfully. So I got, I guess you could say, lucky. And though it's far from perfect, to this day, I have health insurance, and that's a good thing. It's not as good as it could be. It doesn't cover vision. It doesn't cover dental. It doesn't cover so much. And it's far from affordable for most people, too, although it's gotten better since the pandemic, but we can talk about all those things. So tell us the book, The 10-Year War. Do you cover the spectrum of the legislation from the beginning to where we are today?
Yeah, yeah, I know. I mean, it's very much an attempt. I mean, one of my goals in writing this was that 50 years from now, people might want to look back and say, well, what was this law? You know, knows what it'll look like then. And how did it come to be? Why did it look like it did? So I wanted to write a history of it. And, you know, I call it the 10-year war because it is very much a story about the fight over the Affordable Care Act. I mean, it's in many ways more of a book about politics than policy. I very much see this as a case study in how American politics have become dysfunctional and why our governing institutions don't work. And the 10-year period is November 2008. So that's when Barack Obama gets elected president,
right?
Democratic majority, through November of 2018, which is when the Republicans lose their House majority. And that's when their ability to pass a repeal bill, which they've been talking about for so many years, basically ends. But, you know, people have noticed this. And of course, I knew this going in. The first third of the book, literally one, the book has kind of three parts. And the first third is all before November 2008. It's everything leading up to that. Because I think if you can't understand Obamacare and why it looks like it does and how it turned out the way it did without understanding the conditions that led to it and also the work that went into it. For so much before. So there's a lot, it's very much, I'm not a Marvel Universe fan. My kids are. I guess you could say part one of the book is the origin story.
Ah, the origins as opposed to the oranges of the Affordable Care Act. Well, you know, it was a long time coming. And you know, I covered it on the radio back in those days. And so it's still, you know, those memories. And I still have my archives because I'm a bit anal and I hold on to these audio clips. So I go back and I find the clips from March 23rd, 2010. And this happened.
Today, after almost a century of trying, today, after over a year of debate, today, after all the votes have been tallied, health insurance reform becomes law in the United States of America.
Okay, and?
This legislation will also lower costs for families and for businesses and for the federal government, reducing our deficit by over $1 trillion in the next two decades. It is paid for, it is fiscally responsible, and it will help lift a decades-long drag on our economy. That's part of what all of you together worked on and made happen.
So we're 10 years into it now, not decades, but did that hold true?
That set of promises mostly did, actually. You know, one of the things I talk about a lot in the book is that the Obama administration and the Democrats, you know, that second part of that clip you played, Obama was talking about how this was a fiscally responsible bill. It paid for itself. And by and large, it did. I mean, there were so many changes and there were parts that were repealed. It's a little bit hard at this point to sort of say whether the net effect on the deficit was positive or negative. And it kind of depends on like how you take into account tax changes and such. But in general, I mean, they really did, you know, work very hard to create a program that would pay for itself and actually reduce the deficit. And they succeeded in that, for better or worse. I mean, looking back, You know, I would say some of the shortcomings, and there are a lot of shortcomings, and I talk a lot about the flaws, and you alluded to some of them in your introduction. It still isn't affordable for a lot of people.
No.
Well, a lot of that, you know, traces back very simply to the fact that they didn't spend more money. If the Affordable Care Act had more money spent, it was spending more money. The insurance would be a lot more generous for some.
And now, and I think a lot of people don't get this. What happened is after Biden came in. During Trump's reign of terror, it was suggested that he could open the exchanges again. So people who were losing their insurance coverage because they lost their jobs because of the pandemic could get covered, and they refused, obviously. Biden came in and said, that's exactly what we're going to do. Not only that, because now there was money to help thanks to the two rescue bills that passed. They have injected more money into it. So they told you, and I know I took advantage of it immediately, and I hope others listened to my directive to go back on the exchange and go through the application process again, because the subsidies are much larger. Both myself and my daughter, each of us basically save about $100 a month, which is a lot of money. And so my premium went from, I think it was over $290 something to like $159. I'm just pulling numbers out of the air, but that big of a difference. So, you know, it's more affordable now than it was. And Joe Biden says he wants to make those changes permanent, which is, it's to me, it's like one step up and two steps back. Because my next question is, what about the public option he promised us?
Yeah. So first of all, such an important point. And if we can do some public service journalism here, if
Please.
You are getting coverage on buying on your own through healthcare.gov or, you know, one of the
state exchange, same thing.
Yeah. Now do what Nicole did. Check the prices. And if you don't have insurance, check the prices.
Right. Because you can still get it through, I believe, through the end of August. The exchanges are open. So if you don't have insurance, go to healthcare.gov or your state exchange. Go through the process. You can go through the entire application process. And if you don't want to do it at the end, you just don't do it. But at least you'll know what your options are and what's available for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it might be August 15th instead of August 31st. I'm not sure. So double check that, but definitely August. And yeah. And people are saving lots. And some people are saving $100 a month. Like some people are saving more. These policies have gotten a lot cheaper.
Yep.
For a lot of people. And you never know, you know, it might turn out, you know, depending on your circuit, you might qualify for Medicaid. I mean,
that's
some people could get free policies. So please do check. That's not a political message. It's a public service.
It is a public service message. Absolutely.
Now to switch to the politics,
yes,
this was in a lot of ways, you know, they the architects of the law understood that it was going to be underfunded, that especially as, you know, for low income people, if you're on Medicaid or you got a really big subsidy, then it tended to be a very good deal, but very quickly turned into not such a good deal. And as you got to higher incomes, middle higher incomes.
Right, because between the premium cost and then the deductible was insane. Right. But right now it's a better situation. But overall, if this is not permanent, then it's not a fix. It's a temporary fix.
Right. So they're hoping to make it permanent. The politics of it line up nicely. I mean, the Democrats are taking a page from the Republicans here and saying, aha, we know this is always what Republicans do with tax cuts, right? They
That's
make
right.
it for 3 or 4 years and like, oh gosh, we're not going to let that expire. You know, that is on the menu. And then there's a whole other set of kind of options they're looking at to go beyond that. And there's a lot, you know, it's a little bit complex because right now the Biden administration, the Democrats, their list of what they want to do, it's such a long list, right? And they're all important ideas, right? I mean, there's climate, there's childcare. I mean, these are all very important priorities. Healthcare is on that list too.
Yes.
And they have a bunch of ideas. You mentioned one, which is a public option. This is something that you remember. We all talked about it back in 2009.
Oh, we did. Yes, we did.
You know, Biden endorsed that. And certainly a lot of people were very excited about that. I think a lot of people were excited about it, both for the practical idea that they wanted a government plan that they could enroll in. But also, I think symbolically, if you believe that the best possible system is a Medicare for all system, something where the government insures everybody, you recognize that that's just not in the cards right now. It's just politically that the votes aren't there. This was a down payment. I will be honest with you. And I think everybody up to and including Bernie Sanders would agree with me on this. There's not a lot of energy behind that particular idea right now in Congress.
Nope.
Partly, though, to be fair, that's because there are several other ideas also in the mix. And some of them, if, you know, I think number one, they have a lot of promise to make healthcare more affordable. And number two, if you are the type of person who very much wants to see Medicare for all. And so let's say, for example, you're Bernie Sanders. Some of these ideas are quite appealing because they move you closer to Medicare for all, but in a kind of different way. So an example would be something that he is very excited about, which is adding some benefits to the Medicare program itself.
Like I mentioned, vision and dental and things like that. Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, adding those, because Medicare, I mean, one of the things that doesn't get talked about a lot, but the actual Medicare program, which we all revere, you know, Lyndon Johnson, 1965, the thing that all our, you know, all seniors are on, actually by itself, that program is missing a bunch of key elements have never been updated. And so vision, dental, hearing, there's another idea is to lower the eligibility age.
Yes,
so,
please. Says the woman who will be is 61. You know, I've never wanted to be 65 more in my life. And, you know, I've got 4 years to go. So, no, I bring it. Just lower the age. Do something. Right. And they are talking about that.
They're talking about that. They are also, now there's some other ideas in the mix too. One of them is filling what's called the Medicaid gap. And the story there, as you remember, a big part of Obamacare, and really I think the part that never got, maybe this has changed recently, but for most of the law's history, never got the attention and never really got the appreciation of the sort of private healthcare parts of it. You know, we always talk about the exchanges, right? Well, you got to go on healthcare.gov. It's not working. The policies are too expensive. Well, the single biggest impact of the law was the expansion of Medicaid, which is, you know, for people, your income is below the poverty line, just above it. But the key was, in part because of a 2012 Supreme Court decision, your state had to agree to it, right?
And so, right.
And are you still, where are you?
I'm still in Florida, who never took a Medicare expansion, Medicaid expansion.
No Medicaid expansion in Florida. There's no, I mean, not what are the states that haven't, you know, right? It's, it's Florida, it's Texas, it's Georgia. I mean, you know, you can predict.
Oh, yeah.
I live in Michigan. We have it in Michigan. It's been a huge boon. It's helped enormously. It's gotten people insurance, and there's and we have data, really good data on it, so we can say, hey, these people, not only do they get insurance, but you know, the program's not perfect, but they're getting to the doctor.
Right. They're getting the care they need. I mean, if you need to see a doctor, you can see a doctor, and that hasn't always been the case. So but there are still these handful of states, Republican run states, that would not take the Medicaid expansion, even though with this new program, they made it even more attractive. And it was set up so that it didn't cost the state anything for like the first 10 years. And they're bitching, well, what about after that? We're going to have to pay 20%. Or, you know, they found every reason to not take the gift that was being given them. This deal made that even more attractive, and they're still not doing it.
They're still holding out. And so there's talk about doing something about having the federal government somehow foot that bill. It's politically, you know, you have to think about all of these, you know, politically what's going to drive it forward. You know, it's pretty obvious the Medicare changes, right? That's a constituency that matters. There's a clear need with Medicaid, also a clear need, not necessarily a constituency that always matters in politics, right? If you're poor, you don't have the same influence. But for the Democrats, who do tend to care a lot, you know, they do certainly more than Republicans care about.
Exactly. Right.
But also, why do they have a majority in the Senate? Because of Georgia. What did the two Georgia Democrats run on? Medicaid expansion.
Yeah.
So there is, that's got a big power vote. And then the other thing, and there's like another basket of healthcare reform that we're talking about right now, and it's really important, which is prescription drugs.
Oh, yes. And in fact, you have a piece up today at HuffPost about,
Senator,
is this Senator Blumenthal? Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon is working on a bill. So tell us what this is about. This is.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, one of the ideas that's been kicking around forever, and which in my context, your context is, you know, 10, 20 years.
That's right. Which is forever. Yes.
Forever. Has been, you know, had our drug named brand drugs in the United States just way more expensive than in any other country. Mm-hmm. And that is because in every other country, the government can negotiate prices directly with the manufacturers. And you know, the manufacturer doesn't get to just say, we're going to charge X, and the country says, fine, we'll pay it. They go back and forth. We don't have that power in the United States. For a long time, people have wanted to give the United States that power. Obviously, politically, it's tough because it means you're fighting the drug industry, which is really hard. You could make a case they are the single most powerful lobbying group in Washington. They make formidable arguments and that need to be taken seriously, which is that, you know, they say if you pay them less, they're going to do less innovation. You're not going to get breakthrough drugs. And I don't think at the end of the day, those arguments are correct, but there are serious versions of those arguments that deserve to be debated, certainly. And partly because you got the pharma lobby and partly because Republicans don't want anything to do with this, and for a variety of reasons, the assumption has been you can't pass something like this. But there's a lot of reasons why this might go forward. There's a lot of momentum behind it right now, more than we've seen before. The House kind of went below the radar screen if you didn't follow it. But, you know, in 2019, Nancy Pelosi and got together with the different factions of the House Democrats. You know, they passed a bill. They actually passed a bill to do this. And it wasn't, you know, it's like the Affordable Care Act, far from, you know, your ideal version of this, but would have gotten the job done somewhat. And of course, it didn't go anywhere in the Republican Congress. Well, now you have a Democratic Congress and there's talk about doing it. And, you know, this is a pretty popular issue politically. You got to fight the pharmaceutical industry, but you do have a midterm election coming up, right? And who votes in midterms? Senior citizens. Yeah. So, you know, that's a
good
issue.
Right. That's good.
And the key piece, and I do feel like this is a big motivation for this, if we were to adopt something like the House bill or some other version of it, obviously it means we pay less, you and I pay less, you know, if it's done well. If you and I would pay less when we get our drugs at the pharmacy.
That would
pharmacy.
Be a nice thing, yeah, right.
But in addition to that, it means that the federal government spends a lot less money on Medicare.
Right.
Now, that savings can then be used to pay for some other stuff. So what we were talking about before, you want to add a dental benefit to Medicare, you want to lower the eligibility age, you want to fill the Medicaid gap for Florida and Georgia, you're going to need money to do that. Well, prescription drug reform gets you that money. So my mantra on this has been, you know, you would not want to bet on prescription drug reform happening, but I'm not ready to bet against it yet either. I think there's more of a shot here, certainly, than we've had before, and I think more than I think a lot of people in Washington realize.
Now, unfortunately, the thing we're speaking with Jonathan Cohn, whose new book is out, "The 10-Year War," about the battle around healthcare in America. And you also find Jonathan at HuffPost.com. The problem is the same problem we're looking at now. The problem that they encountered last night in a cloture vote to open debate on the For the People Act, and that is the filibuster. And you have Mitch McConnell, who is singing the same song he sang, you know, when Obama was in office. I will give them nothing. We will just hold them up. We will be obstructionists all the way, although he doesn't put it in those terms. It's exactly what he's doing. The fact that they would not even debate making our elections more secure is sickening. As we're talking about healthcare, it's really sickening. And so he's not going to give the Democrats any victory. And as long as he needs 60 votes to do anything, I think his game plan is going to be, I'm letting nothing through.
Well, I agree 100%. And this actually gets back to the book, which is a big part of the book is, you know, understanding why the Affordable Care Act looks like the way it does. Mm-hmm. You were talking before about the compromises. Well, why? A huge reason is that they needed 60 votes in the Senate. That drove so many decisions. If they could have passed something with 50 votes in the Senate, you would have ended up with a program that was a lot more generous.
A lot better. Yep.
A lot simpler, a lot more effective. But the problem was, you know, everything, they had to get 60 votes. They had exactly 60 Democratic senators.
Yep.
And that meant that everything had to get the approval of Joe Lieberman in Connecticut, who was conservative.
Max Baucus.
Ben Nelson. Ugh. Nebraska. I mean, these names, you remember
Max
them.
Baucus,
if you read the book, you'll read about them. Mary Landrieu.
Oh, yes.
Louisiana.
Yeah, Olympia Snow, Max Baucus, Lincoln.
Max Baucus wrote the bill, right?
Right.
He's from Montana.
The worst. He was the worst. And the Democrats gave on so many issues in committee. And this is the thing that was, it was written in three different committees and debated ad nauseum, despite the fact that Republicans kept saying they did it in the middle of the night, in the dead of night. We never saw it. Bullshit. It was written in three committees and debated nonstop. This went on forever. And the Democrats kept giving them so they would, on one issue, they'd give some ground, and another they'd give some ground, and then it would come to vote on the bill, and the people that they gave these concessions to voted against it anyway. Which,
So I mean, what, and I think what, you know, one theme that comes out in the book, I tried to sort of bring out, was how many of the concessions, I mean, they did spend a lot of time trying to get Republicans. They desperately wanted Republican votes. And I, you know, and I actually, you know, if you read the book, there's a lot of like memos from like Max Baucus and conversations inside the White House from early 2009 as they were thinking through their strategy. And they did desperately want Republican support. Yeah. And some of this was, you know, Baucus, I think, believed strongly. He thought if they had Republican support, it would be stronger politically afterwards. I think that is true. The problem was they couldn't get, it wasn't going to happen. I mean, in a world where you could get 10 Republicans voting for this, sure, that would have been great, but that wasn't going to happen. But to be fair to them, and I hope the book makes this clear, one of the things driving them to negotiate with the Republicans was the conservative Democrats. And, you know, back then, the Senate Democrats looked different back then. You had senators from you know, Democrats from Arkansas, from North Carolina, from Louisiana, from Montana. Well, we have one from Montana now, too. But you had these conservative Democrats in conservative states who, frankly, felt like they couldn't look like they were partisan. So they were insisting constantly, like, you have to bargain with the Republicans or we're not going to go along. And that drove so, and there was even a version of this in the House. I mean, there was a big Democratic majority in the House, and Nancy Pelosi, I think, you know, if you want to see kind of how a master legislator works, read about Nancy Pelosi and how she put the, you know, how, what she did in the House. But, you know, both of them, you know, Harry Reid in the Senate, Nancy Pelosi, it was so hard to get those conservative Democrats on board. And that so many compromises. And if they could have had 50 votes in the Senate, you wouldn't have had to bother with all those conservative Democrats. You would have gotten a much better bill.
Absolutely. You know, you met Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell is the thorn in the Democrat side. And so this is right after the bill passed.
Mr. President, a little earlier today, the president signed the Democratic health spending bill into law, and he used the occasion to point out a number of things he wants people to know about it. Now he'll travel around the country talking the bill up to a skeptical public. Clearly, Democrats in Washington still don't get it. Americans already know what's in this bill.
Okay. He goes on and on bad-mouthing it, saying, they didn't want it, and you pushed it through anyway. Well, the people did want it. That's why we voted. That's why Obama was elected. It had a shaky beginning because, again, the gaslighting, it was as bad then as it is now. The one thing Mitch McConnell is very good at is twisting the truth and gaslighting the country. And but the thing is, once people got on board, got the insurance, it has come back up. It's more popular now, I guess, than it ever was. It took a while, but it did take a selling job, despite what he said.
It did take a selling job. You know, the whole third part of the book. So the first part's before before Obama gets elected. The second part is just the fight to pass the law, and then the third part is everything afterwards. It really focuses more on the Republicans and their assault on the law and how that all turned out.
Wow.
And I think, again, this is very much a case study in how our politics is today. The all-out war from the Republican Party from day one. No hope. It was always from day one, we're going to repeal this thing. We don't want to talk about any kind of compromises. We don't want to talk about anything to modify it, to fix it. No. We are determined to tear this thing down. And they had court cases.
And repeal and replace. And never once in these 10 years did they come up with a plan. Not once.
Right. Not once. And you know, you talk about McConnell. I thought some of the most interesting reporting I did was on the Republicans and on repeal. The number of Republicans who talked to me after their repeal effort failed and said, you know what? We had no idea what we were doing. We never prepared for this. We never took it seriously. And you know, you mentioned earlier how long the Democrats, I mean, the Democrats took a year, and it good, slightly more than a year writing this bill. Yeah. It was painful and it hurt them politically. But by the end of the process, everyone knew what they were doing. They were invested in it and they were able to get it through. Republicans never, and they had done all that homework before, that whole, like, again, in the first part of my book, I talk about this, all the preparation. They had thought through all the policies. They really organized the interest group. They really just, you know, this was something they really cared about. For Republicans, it was a slogan. We're going to get rid of Obama's law. It had very little, frankly, I think, to do with what was in the healthcare law. And they got the power and they really didn't know what they were doing. And it came back to haunt them. And, you know, McConnell, one thing's McConnell's a genius. One thing I sort of make the point in my book is that McConnell is very good at blocking things. Mm-hmm. He's good at blocking Democratic laws and he's good at filling judicial appointments.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a very different skill set to pass a law. And as good as Harry Reid was at that in the Senate, as good as Nancy Pelosi was at that in the House, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell were bad at it. And McConnell in particular, I think, really just does not know how to do that. It's a very passing a law is very complicated.
But they don't seem to legislate. They just seem to obstruct.
That's
what he's good at.
And again, you know, in the book, I was amazed the number of Republicans on the record who talked about that to me, you know, former staff, former officials said, yeah, you know what? We don't know. There's one. And some of it is also just not, I don't think they, healthcare doesn't matter. I mean, you know, this isn't the DNA of being a Democrat, right? I mean, this is Harry Truman stuff. This is Franklin Roosevelt for freedoms, right? And this is, you know, if you're a Democrat, a right to healthcare, I mean, whatever, you're for single payer, you're not for, but you're a Democrat, like, you believe in this. This is part of why you became a Democrat.
Sure.
Like, Republicans don't care. There's a quote in my book from a former Republican staffer, Paul Ryan, who said, you know, Republicans, they do taxes and national security. They don't do health care. I think that says it all.
That does say it all. And the fact that this Supreme Court just last week finally said no again to overturning Obamacare, hopefully the Republicans got the message and they'll move on to try to obstruct something else. I don't know. I wish they would just go away. Yeah. Jonathan Cohn, again, the book is The 10-Year War. It is available now. Sounds great. I have it on my Kindle. I'm going to start reading it. I'm so glad. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about this today. It's really important and getting that public service message out as well, that people can get insurance now, and it's a lot less expensive than it was. So do check that out. Jonathan, as always, thank you. It's great seeing you.
Thanks. It's great to talk to you again.
You as well. All right. You take care. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Jonathan Cohn, everybody. And with that, we are done for the day. So I'll tell you what, tomorrow is Thursday. Howie Klein will be here. And as usual, I will leave you with the news because I barely scratched the surface today. Have a great one. Till tomorrow. Bye.
I read the news today. Oh, boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The For the People Act, HB1 in the House, S1 in the Senate, came up for a vote Tuesday in the Senate where Republicans did what they do best. They shut it down with their wall of obstruction and the filibuster. It came down as expected. In a dead-even 50-50 vote, Vice President Kamala Harris was presiding, so she was there to cast the tie-breaking vote, making it 51-50, ostensibly giving the win to the Democrats. But that's not what happened, because our democracy is not very democratic. With Republicans invoking the filibuster, the Democrats needed 60 votes to pass the procedural hurdle to open debate on the matter, effectively killing it on the spot before it even began, when not a single Republican senator would join with the Democrats to start debate. Amazing. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called the Republicans' block of the bill indefensible and ridiculous.
Senate Republicans have signed their names in the ledger of history alongside Donald Trump, the big lie, and voter suppression. Today, every single Democratic senator stood together in the fight to protect the right to vote in America. The Republican leader uses the language and the logic of the Southern senators in the 60s who defended states' rights. This vote, I'm ashamed to say, is further evidence that voter suppression has become part of the official platform of the Republican Party.
Although the thorn in the Democrat side, Joe Manchin, did ultimately vote yes with the rest of the caucus, he's still clinging to the past when the Senate was a more collegial chamber.
Your Democratic colleagues are saying this moment illustrates exactly why the filibuster needs to be changed. You disagree with that?
Some of the things we've done over the years, let's go back and look how many times they had to bring things back and rework them until we finally got a bipartisan buy-in. And I think this is no different.
Joe Manchin is in the minority among his Senate colleagues. Senator Sherrod Brown is ready to take the next step.
Do you feel like now's the time to change the filibuster?
I've thought it for some time. Mitch McConnell is part of this effort by Republicans to suppress the vote. They know they can't win elections anymore. They lost the popular vote by millions of votes. They lose overall votes for the House and Senate. And the only way they can win is change the electorate. And Republican senators almost to the person blindly follow McConnell when he does this.
Does Biden need to get involved?
I think we need to figure out how to do this. I don't care what it takes.
So what happens next? Well, Democrats say they will take on the issues from other angles. Huh? The Senate Rules Committee plans to hold a series of hearings, including in Georgia, calling for passage of new legislation. They're also looking at pushing the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, a different bill that shores up some of the provisions of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Since that time, it's been renewed fairly regularly, usually by overwhelming majorities, until 2013, when the Supreme Court in Shelby County versus Holder basically gutted it by invalidating Section 5, which subjected states to preclearance before making any changes. The Democrats introduced the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act coming up to fix the problems created by Shelby County. But obviously, we're moving in the wrong direction. CNN showed a clip from a USAID television news interview program from 1963. Martin Luther King Jr. was the guest. He spoke about voter suppression issues plaguing the black community back then, proving that the more things change, the more they stay the same.
I think the tragedy is that we have a Congress with a Senate that has a minority of misguided senators who will use the filibuster to keep the majority of people from even voting. They won't let the majority of senators vote. And certainly they wouldn't want the majority of people to vote because they know they do not represent the majority of the American people. In fact, they represent in their own states a very small minority. Senator Eastland of Mississippi represents a very small minority of the number of people who live in that state. And I think this is true all across the South.
Shockingly, that is Martin Luther King Jr. from July 5th, 1963. Wow. In COVID news, experts now say that the new Delta variant could cause a full-on resurgence of the coronavirus in the United States in the coming months. Are you hearing this? The most recent model finds that a highly contagious variant, even coupled with 75% of eligible Americans getting vaccinated, could result in more than 3,000 COVID-19 deaths per week at various points during the fall and winter. Obviously, a huge increase over recent summer lows. And a 75% vaccination rate isn't even a reality yet. The White House admitting that the country will likely fall short of Biden's goal of a 70% partial vaccination rate among adults by July 4th. College students and workers around the country are also starting to balk at vaccine requirements set by their schools or employers. Dr. Fauci isn't backing down.
We're almost at the 70% vaccination with one dose of adults when we reach the 4th of July. If we don't get it by then, we're going to get it within a week or so. But we don't want to stop there. That's an aspirational goal. The goal line is crushing the virus with as many vaccinations as you possibly can.
So New York City went to the polls Tuesday in its mayoral primary. For the first time ever, they're using a ranked choice voting system, which does away with the need for a runoff. Instead of casting a single vote for a single candidate, voters choose up to five candidates and rank them in order of preference. And with each round of counting, the candidate with the least number of votes is eliminated, and their ballots are distributed according to the number two pick and on down the line for subsequent counts. This means that there will be no clear winner for possibly a few weeks, though the field will narrow along the way. After the first night of counting, Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams is in the lead with 31% of number one votes. This after 90% of the in-person ballots were counted. In second place, civil rights attorney Maya Wiley, who had 22%, followed by former city sanitation chief Catherine Garcia with 20%. Andrew Yang, former Democratic presidential candidate, conceded Tuesday night after coming in fourth. Congress is leaving again, this time for 2 weeks for the 4th of July holiday, not returning until July 12th. But before they go, they still have some important work to get done. On Wednesday, the House Judiciary Committee is holding a markup on 6 antitrust bills aimed directly at some of the biggest names in tech: Facebook, Apple, Amazon, and Google. It's led by a bipartisan group of progressive Democrats and conservative Republicans who sit on the Judiciary Committee. This also marks the biggest antitrust effort by Congress in decades. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.